Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. And before we get started with today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkamalum and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. And today, May 5th, is also the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit Peoples. And today essentially is a day of mourning, but also awareness, working towards raising awareness and advocating for the end of violence against Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit Peoples. It also coincides with something called the Red Dress Project. Today is also referred to as Red Dress Day, and it's a campaign that launched in 2014 by Métis artist Jamie Black and has been used to symbolize the thousands of missing and murdered women, girls, and Two-Spirit Indigenous peoples. And here at SFU, there is always a lot of things going on regarding this. A lot of resources that you can find online if you go to sfu.ca. Things that they suggest you do to support the day, talking about wearing red, attending an awareness event, of which there are many on campus. I believe there's one at 1 p.m. today here in the Student Union Building. Hang a red dress in your window to support women who are on the front lines fighting every day. And read the final report from the National Inquiry on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit Peoples. And then donate to initiatives to support Indigenous women in your community, specifically in Vancouver. And locally, there's the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, but there's also the Native Women's Association of Canada and the Aboriginal Mother Center Society. We have not been able to speak to anyone yet. There will be some more coverage later today, but last year, on the very same day, May 5th, our programming coordinator, Jesse Wensloff, went over to the table, which is currently there at the Student Union Building, and spoke with some of the organizers involved with today. So without further ado, here is that piece from Jesse.
The red dress hanging from a window, a porch, or a doorway is a powerful symbol and a reminder of the ongoing epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Monday, May 5th was Red Dress Day and the National Day of Awareness and Remembrance for the missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and 2SLGBTQI+ people. And red dresses hang throughout all three campuses of Simon Fraser University. At the entrance of the Burnaby campus's Student Union Building, a memorial display has been set up by SFU's Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, or SVSPO, and the Women's Center, giving students, staff, and community members the opportunity to remember, memorialize, and pay tribute. Konstantin Lazitsky, a staff member at Out on Campus, SFU's 2SLGBTQI+ student organization, attended the memorial.
I think it's a very powerful symbol of the red dress because it is so striking and so visual, and then it reminds you just seeing one or two, and then you start seeing more and more of them around campus, seeing them on different campuses, seeing them in the community, just to give you a tangible way to realize the scope of what is happening and how it isn't just, oh, somebody else's cousin or sibling is lost, or somebody else in the community that I'm not really connected to. All of those stories are real, but they may not connect to you in, on the same way as it is hundreds and thousands of people that should be here, that should be in community, that should be still doing everything they wish to do, but instead they're not here with us. And so I think it is a way to bring some sort of symbol of them back, to bring something that was taken away, that is no longer here, to bring the people who are important back into the communities where they matter. And so I think it is so important to see visible and proud declarations that this is a day to remember all of the folks that were taken and they're gone and that we're hoping will one day be returned to their communities.
Paula Quilos-Cruz is an educator with the SVSPO and helped organize the memorial.
Today we are hosting awareness tables and memorials in the three different SFU campuses in Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey. We wanted to make sure that non-Indigenous people have a space where they can come and honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, learn more about it, what actions they can take, to reflect also on their own commitment and how we can change this epidemic as well. And then to have a space to meet with other people and maybe do some coloring pages and some pins. Also bring offerings to the memorial table, or they can take one of the flowers that we have there and they can bring it back to the land or a park close to their home. Thinking about all those sisters and friends and grandmas and aunties and the daughter of someone and some other folks who are no longer here because of this colonial epidemic that is happening in Canada. The Red Dress started as a campaign many years ago that was entitled the Red Dress Project, and it was launched in 2014 by Métis artist Jamie Black. And what this artist wanted to do was to honoring all these women who are no longer here with one red dress. And so that is the symbolism of the red dress, the ones that are not here, but that again are present, and it should be in all our memories to remember that is not something that we need to forget.
Quilos-Cruz started by connecting with Indigenous-led organizations on campus.
It was very important first to consult with the staff from Indigenous Student Center, as we wanted to, of course, honor the Indigenous voices and how we could do this in a respectful way.
This consultation helped ensure the event was culturally appropriate, and the collaboration led to a display that is engaging and interactive.
I thought that having a memorial table is really important, just to pace yourself and stand in front of this table and reflect what is happening here, and also make the table interactive. So that's why we invite people to bring offerings like a leaf or a stone or anything that they wanted to bring to the table. But if they couldn't, then they will have the possibility to take something from the table and connect with the land, because we know that Indigenous folks are connected with the land, and then the land is also part of their lives. So as a way to kind of honoring both things.
Julia Lane is one of the many people who stopped by the memorial.
I am here because I think it's incredibly important on this day, but also all days, for us to remember and hold very close in our hearts the kin who we have in the larger human context of being related to one another, who have been stolen from us, whether that is being murdered or by being stolen and they are now what we would call missing Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, and recognizing that that is a really horrifying, tragic, and violent part of ongoing colonization in these lands. I'm feeling I came in feeling overwhelmed, so I'm feeling overwhelmed, but I'm also feeling really grateful to the folks who put it together and put it on as a place for us to hold those feelings of sadness and overwhelm together. And I'm feeling very grateful for the invitation that I was offered to take a rose and to bring the rose to the land, because it feels like an active thing that I can do and an opportunity to remember the women and the girls and the Two-Spirit people, and also hold beauty and remember that there is beauty in addition to all of the harm and the hurt and the sadness.
One of the activities at the memorial prompted visitors to take a piece of paper shaped like a dress and write down actions to help raise awareness and work towards ending the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. As Lane explains, it can be a daunting challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to think about what kinds of actions are helpful, because I feel like so often actions that we hear about or think about or talk about are just not enough. And I feel that. So yeah, I guess one of the things that I've been reflecting on recently is just like recognizing and naming that all the like really deeply insidious ways that violence is interconnected. Violence against so many folks, violence against women, and violence against the land. And so recognizing these intersections and these interconnections and naming them and calling them out and being really consistent about that so that we are able to challenge the more like insidious forms of this kinds of toxicity and violence when it comes up might be a way that we help to keep it from escalating into the really extreme forms of violence that also continue to happen.
Regardless of what suggestions might be made, Kilos Clues hopes that students and community members can take something hopeful and useful away from the memorial.
So just to reflect and learn more about the history of Canada, because there could be some students that maybe are just arriving, they don't know what happened before. So learn more about the history. They can hang a red dress in their window, or they can wear all this week red if they want. Also reading the final report from the National Inquiry of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls and see how they can work in one of those actions, and also as individuals, an invitation to reflect what as change makers, because we are all change makers in this community, they can do in order to bring more awareness or share this with family or talk with their partner, with their friend, and support different Indigenous initiatives here on campus and also outside of campus, challenge lots of biases and stereotypes towards Indigenous people. So there are so many ways that folks can create action towards this. It could be something small, something big, but at the end of the day, if we are actioning something, then we're making a difference.
For CGSF, 90.1 FM Burnaby, on the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples, I'm Jesse Wentzloff. This report is made possible by support from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and can be found online with stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Thank you again to Jesse for that piece that he produced last year. There is another memorial event and table here, not just at SFU Burnaby, but on the other SFU campuses as well. So at SFU Burnaby, this memorial can be found at the Burnaby Student Union Building reception area, the Surrey campus of SFU in the mezzanine, and the Vancouver campus at the Harbor Center lobby. It is going to be a memorial table with an interactive space for self-reflection to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. They invite you to bring a meaningful yet simple object to the memorial table, such as a flower, a stone, a kind note, a leaf, or a little painting. Once again, you're listening to Speak Up Only on CJSF 90.1 FM. And wherever you are, I hope that you can take some time today to honor the missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people that that still need awareness, that still need your support, and still need intervention to address this ongoing crisis. Anyways, we have a few more pieces for the hour for all of you. This next one is coming out of CICK News in Smithers, BC, and it relates to what is seemingly going to be a pretty hot and dry wildfire season. Please take a listen.
You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, the Northwest Fire Center is already attending to wildfires in the region and gearing up for what could be a very hot and dry fire season. Some critical crews are already in place throughout the region, and more are currently being trained. This month, the BC Wildfire Service is confident all resources will be in place to defend against potential wildfires in the coming weeks and months. The Northwest Fire Center's headquarters is in Smithers, and I had a chance to tour the facility, the heart of Wildfire Command, and speak with Information Officer Caitlin Bailey to find out what is going to be needed to ensure fire crews have what they need to battle yet another dangerous wildfire season in Northwest BC. Stay with us.
Northwest Fire Center, and it's split into four different zones. So we have the Nadina Fire Zone here, and then Bulkley Fire Zone, Skeena, and then above it is the Cassiar Fire Zone in the north, sort of going up to the Yukon border there. And then the Northwest Fire Center based in Smithers here is like the regional fire center that supports those four different zones.
Yeah.
And within those zones, there's also bases where we have officers and crew staff. So in Nadina, there's one in Burns Lake, as well as in Houston, we have crews and officers. In the Bulkley Fire Zone, there's one in Telqua, as well as in Hazleton.
The Rangers, I see. Okay.
The Rainmakers are the Hazleton crew. Yeah. And then in the Skeena Fire Zone, there's the base in Terrace. And in the Cassiar Fire Zone, we have a base in Dees Lake, as well as in Atlin. And we also use a base in Watson Lake occasionally, sort of on the Yukon side.
Amazing. So it's the largest fire center, is it not?
I think it's the most, the geographical area.
Yeah,
I think so. I'd have to double check, but I think you're right.
And then these are all just magnets that you place when things are going on?
I'm actually not sure how this is used. This is our dispatch room.
Yeah.
So this is where if there's a new fire that's called in by the public, it would go to a reporting center in Victoria, like when you call that 1-800 number, or if you put it on the app in Victoria, and then it immediately gets posted on maps. And then we can see here within dispatch. And we always have the RWCO, which stands for Regional Wildfire Coordinating Officer.
Okay.
So that's a rostered position. So it's a different person potentially every week. And that person is sort of coordinating all of the efforts across the fire center. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So if there's a new fire, it'll come into dispatch.
Yeah.
And then that person and or if we have an operations officer on, will decide sort of what we're going to do working with the zones and the crews, like how we're going to respond to that fire.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So this is the...
This is where it all happens.
Beating heart. Okay.
And then the rest of the fire center is sort of cubicles or like where people are working.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Caitlin Bailey. I'm currently acting as the information officer for the Northwest Fire Center, based here in Smithers.
Great, Caitlin. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about, we're here in end of April and looking at the wildfire app. It already looks like wildfire season is off to a start, and there's a number of fires across the province. I've seen a couple that have come up here in the Northwest region, but maybe you can give us an overview of what we're seeing and the preparations for this coming fire season.
Yeah, for sure. So far within the Northwest Fire Center, since April 1st, which is when our fire season starts, we've seen four wildfires. We currently have crews. Would you like me to explain sort of where we have crews located? So we have four unit crews total. We have one in out of Burns Lake, one out of Telqua, one out of Hazleton, and then one out of Terrace. We also have a 13 initial attack crews sort of based at those locations as well as Houston. And so they're all sort of strategically based on those locations. However, they're quite dynamic, and we move them depending on where the greatest risk is for wildfires. And so right now we are welcoming new staff, new crew members, new officer staff, new building staff. We're doing a lot of training. That's a big part of the spring preparation. We have new recruit boot camps that new firefighters go to. We have local training as well as provincial training that people attend. Crews have been attending chainsaw training. We also have been supporting a number of cultural and prescribed burns in the fire center. And right now we also have a crew that's currently supporting another fire center that's deployed to help them out.
Yeah.
So sort of those are the main preparations that we do in the spring. A lot of training, a lot of like welcoming new staff back and new staff to the organization.
I guess in terms of where these crews are based and some of these other preparations are going on, we just walked by a room and there's training happening today. What's the ideal situation? Like, when are you hoping to have all these pieces in place, all these people trained up? Because we're headed into May, it's getting pretty hot outside. And as I mentioned, you know, speaking with a meteorologist earlier, it looks like we're headed in for another dry summer.
Yeah, totally. So training happens often in April, sometimes into May. However, at this point, even right now, we have crews ready to respond to fires if needed. So we always have that capability, and then we can continue to train as we're sort of able to.
Obviously, with preparations, the crews, but also, you know, there's equipment. Like, what type of equipment? And, you know, I know we often see planes coming in here because of the airport. So, what kind of planning and, you know, strategy is being implemented right now to get prepped for, you know, the height of the season, which probably will be in a couple months?
Yeah, that's a good point. So we also have equipment that we sort of are reaching out to, heavy equipment contractors. There's a number of different contracts that they will be signing now so that they're sort of prepared. And then if we need them in the future, they can be quickly utilized. Similar with, yeah, helicopters. Air tankers are a provincial resource, so we don't do that locally, but they're organized sort of provincially out of Kamloops. And then if we need them, they can come up. However, we do talk to different helicopter companies and are just sort of sorting out all those details so that when something happens, they are ready to respond.
Yeah. I know you mentioned that April 1st is kind of the start, the official start of fire season, but obviously things, you know, start off slow, especially in this region. As you mentioned, you know, we don't often see a ton of fires near the town of Smithers anyway. But being one of the largest fire regions, the Northwest Fire Center, Burns Lake, you know, we often see plenty there. So what's the ideal timeline to make sure that all these things are in place when the fires really start to get going?
Yeah, by the end of this month is when we'll have sort of all of most of those contracts in place.
Okay. The other thing that was curious, and we kind of briefly chatted about it earlier, this building is, you know, has been here permanently for a number of years now, but, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago especially, this was largely seasonal, and it's indicative of how things have changed out in the environment and, you know, the intensity of the fires, the volume of them, even the app that the Wildfire Service has now, you know, that didn't exist, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and it keeps getting better and better. The reporting, as I understand it, being able to send initial attack crews out, the response time has increased. You know, so what has it been like to see all those changes, and now being more of a all year round position, and making sure that these plans are made all year round rather than just, you know, a few months before fire season?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've only worked for BC Wildfire Service since 2023. So a lot of that change and sort of expansion has happened even before I started. But since I started, there's even been more crews and more full-time staff, more of that seasonal staff sort of being transitioned into full-time staff. And it is a busy place, even in the winter, which is, I think, unexpected sometimes. But yeah, all of that staff, we're able to sort of prepare for the summer better, because in the summertime, often we're very busy with just responding to wildfires.
Yeah. Another thing is, you know, from one year to the next, you know, things can change. There are updates, you know, things improve efficiencies. What are some of the major changes that have happened from even from when you first started to this year?
There have been a number of new programs. One of the major things that I've sort of seen happen is the increase in prescribed and cultural burning that's been happening. and those other preventative measures that have been sort of put into place, as well as the app. The BC Wildfire Service app existed before I started. However, just sort of fine-tuning how it's used and all of the different details and mechanisms. And there is a new version this year for people to download as well, or to upload. Yeah. The new version, it's mostly back-end changes, but it'll just make everything work smoother. Yeah.
The other question I have is, you know, just more of what is the Wildfire Service expecting this year? As I mentioned, 2023 was the last, you know, really bad year where we saw, you know, record-breaking number of wildfires, some that burned right through winter in different parts of the province. This year in the north here, we have a pretty decent snowpack. In the south, you know, not so much. But we potentially could be headed into an El Nino with drier conditions. What's the fire service preparing for this year? Are things different than last year? Are there, you know, different measures being taken because of the possibility of it being a particularly hot and dry summer?
Yeah, so the major three things we look at weather-wise are snowpack, drought conditions, and then precipitation. So snowpack at higher elevations is above average this year. There's a lot of snow sort of up in the mountains and a lot of our weather stations in the Northwest. And that often can predict or has an impact on when the fire season starts, whether it's earlier or later. And then there's drought conditions. So at the end of the season in 2025, at the end of October, there was some elevated drought in both the like northern Cassiar part of our fire center, as well as that southern eastern Nedina. And then the last thing is precipitation. And this is the most impactful of whether we'll see that elevated summer season in July and August. And it's really about whether we see rain in May and June, or the June monsoons, as they've been referred to. And it's really hard to predict that. We sort of don't have a good way of predicting that, but that's the biggest impact of whether or not we'll see that elevated summer season, is whether we get that rain.
Yeah. I guess on that note, you know, you mentioned that you get weather reports and kind of make plans accordingly. If you do get weather reports that say, you know, we're not going to see much rain in the next couple of weeks, does that initiate the movement of crews, you know, positioning them around? I know you said they move quite a bit, but when you get those reports, does that, you know, initiate where crews are going to go if you know that a certain area, you know, say north of Terrace or, you know, around Burns Lake isn't going to see a lot of rain? Do you make that preemptive move with crews to just be ready?
Yeah, absolutely. We put the crews where we need to based on the risk of wildfire. Another thing, so there's like the location of where we put the crews, but also how long they're on standby and whether they're on what we call reds. So whether it's extended past the regular day, but also if they're on reds, this means that there's a helicopter ready to take that crew where they need to go, and we can move them that way as well. They're sort of on standby right there, ready to go.
If someone sees a fire out and about, you know, what are the ways to report it? I know there's several. And I've had to call in a couple over the years. But how can people do that? What's the best way to report a fire if they do see something suspicious out and about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So on your cell phone, if you dial *5555, you can report a cell phone, or you can report a wildfire that way. Also, if you have our app, there's a really great feature where you can take photos of the fire or even the smoke that you see, and that can help us out a lot because that photo comes immediately to sort of our coordination center here, and that can help us determine what we send out before we even get eyes on it. You know, you can see a bit of a picture of what we're walking into or what crews are going into. And also with that app feature, you can put all of the information on if you're offline, and as soon as you come online, it'll automatically report that fire. So if you're out of service and you don't have service, you can still put in it'll take your coordinates, it'll take all the information that you can see, it'll ask you a bunch of questions, and then as soon as you come online, it'll send that information to us.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Good luck this season.
Thanks so much, Dan.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at cicknews@smithersradio.com or check us out on the web at smithersradio.com. CICK News has been made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you find your podcasts.